For the last several years, I've had the incredible privilege of studying Israeli poetry with a really world-renowned teacher by the name of Rachel Korazim. So I am going to share some poetry with you this morning on high holiday themes. But I want to say a little bit, first of all, for those of you, because we've done this now for a couple of years, who have more interest in studying modern Israeli poetry, she does offer classes free of charge online. The classes I take with her are usually just for rabbis, but she does have classes that are open to anybody. And she's got, it's just on her website. So if you have any interest in this, let me know after after the holiday's over, and I'll share with you the link to her website. But she's got some really great offerings this fall.
And I have more specific asks than I think ever.
If everybody could please just make sure they're muted. So we're going to talk more today about some beautiful poetry that I had the opportunity to learn from her just recently. But I want to sort of reflect back on when I was in rabbinical school, one of the things that we actually had to study was Israeli literature and Yiddish literature. We had to take a semester on that topic. And the idea was, to quote Mordechai Kaplan, since Judaism is a civilization and civilizations have art and literature, that it would be important to have been conversant in the time in what was part of the literature of our people. And one of the things that I remembered learning that sort of stuck with me is what makes modern Hebrew literature so great, and what made Yiddish literature of the 19th and 20th century so great, is that it was being written by people who were very well versed in the tradition, but were breaking away from the tradition. So it was both true to Judaism and subversive at the same time, which is, I think, if you add sort of that's my happy place, being both traditional and subversive at the same time. So it very often took themes that the reader would be very familiar with, or quotes, even quotes from the Torah or quotes from liturgy, but sort of twisted them in a way to actually sort of rebel against their tradition, or in many ways, sometimes to rebel even against God, but was so steeped in the tradition that you had to be pretty knowledgeable to actually even understand what they were talking about. And so I want to share three poems with you this morning that pretty much do precisely that. These are three poems, and I'm going to put them on the screen in a moment, written by Israeli poets. They're current and they're not famous. So everything that I've sort of mostly shared with you in the past has been by pretty well-known Israeli poets. These are people that are pretty brand new on the Israeli scene. There is a brand new journal of poetry that's published several times a year in Israel. It's called Mashiv HaRuach, which again, Mashiv HaRuach is the prayer for rain. And we don't, most people, I don't even know how many modern Israelis even know that that's a quote from the liturgy, from the Amidah. But the journal itself is, it's bringing rain or bringing abundance or bringing sustenance through poetry. And so I want to share three poems that I had the opportunity to study this week. And so you'll this month, and you'll see that they're all in some ways, as I said, deal with high holiday themes. So I'm going to try something, because there aren't that many of us on Zoom. I'm going to share the poem. I'm going to say a little bit about it, and then we'll see if we can even have a little bit of discussion if anybody wants to comment on the poem, or if anything that you might see in it. So the first one is called Smile. Of course, these were all written in Hebrew. These are all translations. It's really fun. When I had the session with Rachel Korazim, she actually, not a poem that we're looking at right now today, but she had one of the poets who was on, who took issue with the way her poem was translated. It was a really great moment, because the translator, who's actually quite well known, was on, happened to not coincidentally be on the Zoom. And so Rachel was like, well, you know, the woman that translated it has actually translated some of the greatest Israeli poetry. And then the poet was like, I'm sorry. So it was, you know, it's an interesting, I've never had the opportunity to have the poet who actually wrote in Hebrew comment on how she felt about, you know, an English translation, because we know that every translation is an interpretation, and people have to make choices about, you know, about the words that they use. And so perhaps not every poet is gonna, you know, feel so good about how their poem got translated. So this first one is entitled Smile by Avia Weinberg. And so you can see it's a high holiday poem because she talks about atonement. You know, it's so here's a modern poet dealing with a very traditional Jewish theme, the idea of atonement, of amends, making amends for that which you've done wrong. And so grant me atonement. Now, if you think about, and we know, and we assume that the author knows, that when we ask for atonement, if you think about, you know, what we're going to do very soon on Yom Kippur, and we think about we've sinned and we've betrayed and we've stolen and we've murdered and all of the big, you know, we were gluttons and all of the, you know, the big, terrible sins that we've all committed, or we haven't actually all committed many of them, and yet we confess to them anyways. So look at the first thing she says, grant me atonement, atonement for fake smiles, which is very Israeli, actually, if you think about it. Israelis like to tell it like it is, but even they sometimes have fake smiles. And so, you know, grant me atonement for this falseness, atonement for forbidden consolations. You know, we can think about what are forbidden consolations? How do we console ourselves in ways that we probably shouldn't, because they're immoral, or maybe just because they're unhealthy. Hard, blessed atonements. Slice me up to the placated atonements are coming towards me, dimples on cheeks, the pearly white smile of a baby. So placated atonements are innocent like a baby. But my atonement rises. It stands alert. Its hair already turned white. It's not dyed. So it's not a fake smile, right? It's not dyed hair. It's real, right? It's the real atonement. The real atonement is a white-haired woman. And it's not hiding hardship, does not embellish. It wipes a tear, shines with trust, and smiles a second innocence. So a placated atonement is like an innocent baby, but a hard won atonement is like a second innocence. So I'm going to just stop sharing for a minute. I know it may be hard to comment on it if you can't see it in front of you, but what do you think? What's it, Marsha?
I'm fascinated because I'm not sure of the age of this woman. Is the hair already turned white because, in contrast to the baby, she's old, or is it already turned white? Because there are people whose hair turns white at a younger age. Doesn't necessarily mean age. And, oh dear, the line after that.
I can put it back up quickly for you.
Oh yeah, please. The. Yeah, this is, yeah, no embellishment, it's not hiding, but there's trust that there's forgiveness. Yeah. There's trust that you can start again, not as a baby, but, you know, someone who's gone through all of this, but in a different way. And it's terrific.
I mean, I don't know how old she is. I don't know anything about her biography. And because she's not famous, there was, nothing really I could find out about her, though. I'm sure when I meet again with Rachel Korzim, I could ask her. I thought that would be interesting.
But you know, it doesn't have to be about her either.
Right. That's right. That's right. You know, I don't know if people caught how emotional I was yesterday during Avinu Malkeinu, but I have to say, you know, I remember in my youth feeling that, you know, so many of the prayers that we read on the high holidays are, you know, they're outdated. I love them because they're part of our tradition, but they were written by very different people in very different times who had different, you know, expressed themselves in different ways. And I certainly have heard that from other people my entire rabbinic life about how the words of the prayers, you know, don't really speak to them. And then I'm reading this prayer about, you know, save us from fire and save us from water and save us from war and save us from disease. And I thought, how naive, the baby with the pearly white tooth, you know, how naive, how sheltered does a person have to be to think that a prayer about war and floods and famine and disease, like how privileged do you have to be to feel that that prayer was ever outdated? Like I'm ashamed of knowing that I ever felt that way. And I have to say, you know, calling on God seems like a pretty good idea at this point because, you know, things are feeling pretty desperate out there. So, you know, so the difference between atonement, between, you know, placated atonement of a young, you know, more innocent time and the hard won atonement of, you know, of a different kind of a more mature person. I just thought that was a, you know, a beautiful juxtaposition. Does anybody else? Yes, Kate.
Rich and I were just talking and I have a more cynical viewpoint. I'm wondering if the woman, the mature woman is actually demented or in her senility, and that way she's very similar to the baby and is completely, well, could be innocent of whatever.
Laura?
So when I read the piece about fake smiles, the first thing that comes to my mind is this, you know, women being told to smile, you know, smile more. And then you get to this piece of toward the end of, you know, sort of accepting the gray hair. And as a mother of teenage girls and as a leader in a business where I have lots of younger women who work for me and with me, there's a piece of me that looks at it as that, you know, making sure that we're not part of the problem, not giving that fake smile, but calling people out on it. And realizing it's okay to go with the gray hair, or, you know, whatever it is that, to try to stop that cycle.
Nice. Flo?
Well, first of all, Hank and I have studied also with Rachel Kortrecha from Hartman, and we continue to. And one thing that she constantly does, Rabbi, you know this, constantly talks, has the transliteration and, you know, the Hebrew. And so there's this constant discussion about what we see if you just read it in Hebrew versus using the English. Also, I wanted to put in that our women's group, our women's network group, has been reading poetry, Israeli poetry, for quite a while already. So we really love it too. What else was I going to say? I guess that's it.
No, that I mean, that's, you know, it feels complicated to do it by Zoom, though I'm going to show you something in a moment. But when you really look at the Hebrew and you hear, you know, then you hear the liturgical language, or you hear the word or the quote, the word that only appears, you know, in the Torah, which you can't obviously hear in the English. All right, let's
Can I say one more thing?
Oh, sure.
Because yesterday, after we had our service here, our granddaughter, who's a rabbinical student at HUC, is we're supposed to have a student pulpit in Tahoe, but of course it's virtual and she's in LA, but the consortium of the congregations around Tahoe all the way to Sacramento and Santa Rosa, whatever, had services. So we also went in to hear that. And there was quite a bit said about by the rabbi there too, about what you're just talking about by the text and what they have really been going through. It was really, really, you know, moving.
Yes. I feel like the juxtaposition, you know, it's pretty mild here right now out my window, you know, I said this era of Rosh Hashanah, it's very mild, it's really beautiful out right now, and it's so gentle, the nature outside my door, and we're, you know, also in a bubble here. Mm-hmm. All right, so I have three poems today total to share, just so you know where we are. So we're going to do the second one. Those Who Almost. So the first thing to note about this one is no punctuation. I mean, obviously a line break is a decision of punctuation, but no periods, no commas. When we were discussing this poem, one of the other students said, "Oh, like the Torah, right? Where there's you only know how to stop where the trope is." So those who almost. So this is a prayer for God, to God. So this is a prayer, right? This is actually a prayer, but different. Again, you know, we ask God to be with, you know, the sick and the weak and the widow and the orphan, you know, very dramatic categories. But look at this one and see if you fit into any of these or who these people are. Be with those who almost made it to the train. Be with those who do not speak the language, with those who had to get up tomorrow, with those who got to the 18 bus in the wrong direction, those whose shirt does not fit properly, how upsetting. Those who have no reception, those for whom no one ever waits, those who are shortchanged and those who can't find a parking spot, who don't find a job, those who don't find compassion, those who are hungry, who cry out, who forget something important, those who become weary, those who stopped, be with those who almost. So you go from really the most serious, right? People that are hungry, to the people that can't find a parking spot. I won't ask with a show of hands, have you ever prayed to find a parking spot? When you're trying to get somewhere and you're running a little late, you know, people pray about all kinds of things, but you know, have you ever said, please, please, please let me find a parking spot? So who are these people, right? Who are these people who almost made it to the train? You know, what happened to them? What happened to them if they missed the train, if they were late for work, if they, you know, didn't make it on time for their appointment? Was the results benign? Oh, well, you were late, you missed the train, or were there much more serious repercussions, right? We don't know. We just see a slice of them as the train pulls off. But for them, what did that happen? You know, what happened in their life? Those who do not speak the language. I don't know if any of you had grandparents or grandparents or great grandparents even who really didn't speak English very well. Or if you've ever been someplace where you don't speak the language, it's slightly perhaps easier now with Google Translate. But what is it like to be an immigrant who doesn't speak the language? What is that like for that person? Whose shirt doesn't fit properly? How upsetting, right? Those who are shortchanged, those who are hungry, those who almost. So do you see yourself in any of these categories? What do you think about these people? Eileen.
I see this as representing forks in the road, that any small change, whether it's a big deal like not having enough to eat, or a small deal like not being able to find a nearby parking spot, change the course of at least the immediate future, if not the total future. And it's how we react to this change in plans that maybe determines where we go.
Deanna?
So I'm reading it from the opposite perspective of that. I'm reading about, you know, that these things that feel so important in the moment, and some of them are real issues and some of them are First World North Shore issues. But my favorite line of the whole thing was the very end about those who step to be with those who almost, or something like that. And to me, that last line is the important one, that to strive to be the person who, what is it? Those who stop to be with those who almost, that we can strive to be or hope to be the person who recognizes that when somebody is struggling, maybe the reason that they missed the train and it's such a big deal is because many other issues are going on in the back. But for those of us who can stop to see those people, to help those people, have compassion for those people, and to be with those people, would be my goal.
Right. It's, you know, the prayer starts out as if it's a prayer to God, right? Be with these people. I think the prayer opens like we're talking to God. God, don't forget these people. And then ends with the people who are with the people who almost, right? That, Laura?
Just to take it to a far more superficial level, I had to laugh at the shirt not fitting, because I don't know about how many of you, yesterday, for the first time, I had an entire family trying to figure out what fit, because right, nobody had been in dressy clothes for a year and a half. Right. And so that just sort of hit home this week in particular.
Right. It's weird, because I feel like the strangest part about yesterday was not getting dressed up. I was kind of excited to get dressed up. The strangest part of yesterday was showing up at somebody's house for lunch dressed up. We used to do that all the time, but I'm not used to that anymore. But yeah, but then again, you know, for those of you who've ever had that experience where you're actually wearing something, especially as a, I don't know, maybe men's experiences too, but when you're wearing something that doesn't quite fit, and how you feel self-conscious about it and pulling at it all day long, and it makes you aware, and usually it doesn't fit because you put on a few pounds and you feel badly about that. So that shirt that doesn't fit is, but of course, poor people very often, we have the first world problem if our shirt doesn't fit and then we feel guilty because, I should, lose a few pounds. But in many places, people's clothes don't fit because they can't afford clothes that fit. They wear whatever they can have. So you can read both of those things into that. Dan, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I think you could find something serious in any of these. You could find, someone lost weight because they have a medical issue, right? But it struck me more as the contrast between the first world problem and the ones that are more serious. But yet we might curse God the same way and say some kind of I have to get up tomorrow. That's, this is terrible. The one that strikes me the most is when people complain about technology not working. And I can't believe I can't get my phone to connect to a satellite to talk to this other person without static. And it just helps put it in perspective a little bit.
Right. Did you say that, right? The ones that don't have reception, was in that list, right? If you've ever had the experience where your something doesn't work, my printer, whatever, and I have to figure out how to fix it on my own. And it's like, I get so riled up and it's like, wow, compared to, at least I didn't have to type the paper.
Yeah, this amazing technology doesn't work every time.
Right, every single second. Marsha?
I had a question about two parts in there.
Yes. I'm going to put it back up.
Well, thank you. Okay. So much of it is almost. It's almost. But if you don't speak the language, you don't speak the language.
Right.
That kind of stands out as not fitting in. And also those who had to get up tomorrow. And that mixes the whole, falling short, who were trying to, but it didn't work out. It didn't quite work out. So tomorrow is thrown in there too. Okay, tomorrow. But I still don't understand with those who don't speak the language. I don't know why. But I guess all of the rest of that brings in the consequences of all the rest of it. So if you don't speak the language, if you did miss the train, if you, and it kind of, to me, goes with the poem Seeking Atonement, because you all missed the mark. We all missed the mark. And we're looking to tomorrow to do better. But as you said, at the end, we're thinking about the really important stuff. And we come back to God, looking for God's help.
You know, I was also thinking with the language, you know, I was relating to it as an American.
Mm-hmm.
But Israel, of course, is a country of all immigrants. And everybody had to learn how to speak Hebrew. And even now, you know, there are immigrants to Israel who are not, you know, and listen, even now here. But of course, you know, what it means to be sort of an outsider because you really don't speak the language, or even if you speak it, maybe you don't really, you know, you miss things. You miss things. All right, we're gonna do one last one. I'm gonna tell you this is my favorite of all. So before we can understand this poem, we need to look a little bit at the liturgy of Kol Nidre. So at the beginning of Kol Nidre, named after the prayer, we gather ourselves as if we are a court, as if we are a Beit Din. This is actually why, in case you ever wondered, why Kol Nidre services have to start before it's actually dark out. Why are we rushing to start before it's dark out when we, you know, could have an extra, you know, 15, 20 minutes to finish eating? It's because in Jewish tradition, legally, a court cannot meet once the holiday has begun. So because we are constituted as a court, we have to get our court business out of the way before Yom Kippur even starts. And so we say, by the authority of the heavenly court and by the authority of the earthly court, with divine consent and with the consent of the congregation, we hereby declare it permissible to pray with those that have transgressed. Remember Kol Nidre, we're releasing people from their vows, meaning that everybody in the room basically is a sinner because we've all made promises that we haven't kept, but we are going to have a court that releases us from all of the things that we promised that we would do, that we vowed. They're really thinking of it more technically as an oath, that you actually swore by oath that you would do it, and therefore you violated something more seriously than like, I promise I'm going to call you. Like, this is really serious stuff. And so we have three levels, right? We have the heavenly court, whatever that means, probably the angels. We have the earthly court, all of us, and we have it with divine consent and with the consent of this congregation. So now we're going to have a prayer to whom it may concern. So, okay, first of all, let's talk about what it means to have a prayer titled "To Whom It May Concern." That's not, you know, remember I said that it's what I love best about Yiddish literature and some Hebrew literature is that it's both traditional and subversive at the same time. So the first thing is, in order to know this, understand this prayer, you'd have to know Kol Nidre. Like, you'd have to know, and I don't know how many Israelis, secular, modern, young Israelis, have any familiarity with Kol Nidre. They don't go to synagogue. Like, if they go to synagogue, maybe they go on Yom Kippur, but I would bet, you know, the average American Jewish kid that went to Hebrew school is more familiar with the concept of Kol Nidre than that person's average Israeli peer. So you already have to really know something to understand this. But you'll see, to whom it may concern, this is where it gets subversive. So we're calling, by the consent of the omnipresent, the consent of the audience, the assembly, and the assembly, right? So you see how it mirrors the four different courts of Kol Nidre. We have four different courts here too. So we are going to gather together by the consent of the omnipresent, weary of supplications. Right. So that's quite a way to start your Yom Kippur, right? Like, what, God will answer. God is listening. God will hear your prayers. No, you want to really know something about God? He's tired, or he weary of your supplications. And the audience, held captive in auditoriums. I hope none of you feel that way, but you might have had your moments. So by the consent of the omnipresent, weary of supplications, and by the consent of the audience held captive in the auditoriums, by the assembly on the top floors of high rises, and by the assembly on the of the ground floor, the dwellers in the streets, right? So the people in the high rises, we assume are people with some affluence. And then we remember also the ground dwellers, the people, the homeless people, the people that dwell in the streets. So here are all of these people that are going to release you from your vows. And what do they say? We permit you everything. And the court repeats the formula three times. All things are permitted to you. All things are forgiven you. All things help you. And the light is sweet and good to the eyes. And it is permitted to love. No Jewish prayer in the history of Judaism ever said, we permit you everything, right? That in itself is so not Jewish. However, there is one teeny piece of liturgy where somebody is permitted to everyone or to anyone, not exactly to anyone. Anybody have any idea? I'm just gonna stop to share this for 1 minute. Anybody have any idea when somebody is told you are permitted to everyone or to anyone? Yeah, okay, Dan knew over here. When a woman gets divorced, when a woman gets divorced and she's handed her get, she's told she's now permitted to anyone, which means she can remarry, but it's quite a dramatic and painful thing to say, right? At the wedding ceremony, she's mikadeshet li, right? She's sanctified only to him. And when she's divorced, she's muteret lekulam. She's permitted to anyone. So it could refer, you know, but that's an interesting liturgy then, the liturgy of divorce. Like who are we divorcing? Are we divorced from God at this moment? So we permit you everything, as I said, no, not a particularly, not a Jewish concept at all. Judaism is about obligation. But here is this poet's subversive take, right? You're freed from all your vows. You're permitted everything. And because this is a legal formula, the court three times will repeat that. All things are permitted to you. All things are forgiven you. All things help you. And the light is sweet and good to the eyes. And it is permitted to love, which again has the overtones of the divorce ceremony, right? She can have another relationship. Any comments?
That's it, you stumped
it. Deanna?
Is a poet divorced? Has she gone through this kind of separation of the pain surrounding it?
I have no idea of any of the personal, the lives of any of these people because they're not well known to have any like a Wikipedia page. So I don't know anything about them, but I assume that the poet is at least familiar with the divorce ceremony. And that's why there's the shades of that in here. But again, what I love is the juxtaposition between this unbelievable use of the traditional language, but sort of turning it on its head. You know, because the average Israeli's experience is not sitting in a synagogue service, feeling, you know, so I don't know if this person has had that experience. And I don't know, you know, if the average Israeli would relate to that as a religious experience, because it's not one that they necessarily have.
So the reason I'm asking is because it could be comparing, but when she's talking about being held captive in auditoriums, and then like the divorce from the formality of the ritual, right, we'll say, and then allowing the ritual to say, okay, especially because she ends with, you are permitted to love. It's almost like, I kind of wish there was another couple sentences talking about what it is she was permitted. She's asking us to be permitted to love, to love the religion, to love the process of the holidays, of the thinking about it and of contemplating and reflecting. So it's almost, it is a separation, but ending it and permitted to love, drawing the comparison to, okay, let's get out of the part that was unpleasant and grab and reclaim that which is beautiful of the holiday.
I think she's, you know, it's an interesting thing to have to, the beginning of going through a ritual to being told that you're permitted everything. And then permitted everything means you don't really even need that ritual, right? So is it like a circular thing, right? Like you have to go through this ritual and then you're freed because you've gone through the ritual? Or is the very definition of going through this ritual that you don't even need this ritual anymore? Like you're permitted, everything's already permitted, everything's already forgiven. So it's sort of a conundrum. Marsha? Oh, Mark, were you going to say something? I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I thought in a, not cynical per se, but sort of in a more secular view of the holiday in general, that it's like you go through, there's all these proclamations and blah, blah, blah. And then in the end, you say your three lines and everything's permitted and you can just move on and everything's rosy and you can just go on. Love is enough.
Right. Well, sometimes it is.
Right. But I mean, I think it was more of a commentary then, perhaps like what you said, that maybe in Israel, we don't need to go. It's in the end, you go, you say these three lines, and then we're all going to be, everything's permitted.
But, you know, so the other, you know, as a rabbi, the everything's permitted is like stick, you know, that I'm having, you know, I struggle with that one, right? Because it's not a Jewish concept. But I do think about, you know, the idea of, you know, we are supposed to come through Yom Kippur. Of course, we have to make our amends to people that we've hurt, right? Yom Kippur does not atone for the sins between human being to human being. But let's say we did all our work, right? We made our amends. We did what we were supposed to do. We made our amends to God. We are supposed to come out of that feeling like we are a catharsis of having been forgiven. You know, it's not supposed to just be like, well, we checked it off the box. We checked it off. We did it. Like it is supposed to be a soul cleansing process. Marsha, I'm going to give you the last word and then we're going to finish up with Musa.
Okay. A lot of these poems, especially about atonement, make me look and think about what kind of a God are we talking about? What kind of a religion are we talking about? And maybe this last part, well, the last line makes me think of all of the new regulation or deregulation of who a person is allowed to love. Mm. You know, does it have to be a different gender? Does it have to be a gender? But I don't even know if that's where the poet's going with this, but it's the feeling of once you have done the things you need to do, this is what forgiveness looks like, feels like. You are freed from the strictures and you are your own person. And you can go on. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to do the best you can. You're going to miss the train. But this is what it feels like, or hopefully feels like, once you have done, as you said, the work.
Because I just shared the screen again, I also noticed the line too. And I was looking at all things love is that all things help you. You know, this idea of these, you know, I'm not really the person's like, oh, I missed the train. It was for the best. But on the other hand, like these things, these mistakes, these, you know, it's kind of what I spoke about yesterday, right? Like we never allow people to say, I made a mistake and I'm going to make amends for it. But then there's no growth. Rob, I see you put your hand up. So I will.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
So I had two comments. First is, I think in Israel, a lot of people are in forced marriages. They don't have a choice. And maybe it's prearranged. You can say they have a choice, but there's prearranged marriages. Maybe these people are not really truly making that choice. Maybe it's not until they leave that and they're permitted to choose and that they can actually love. That's one comment. The second comment is compare that to God and religion. Maybe it's not until we leave or have serious doubts about our religion and we make a choice to actually pursue or be involved in that religion that we are permitted also to truly love. That's it.
I do want to say there are not prearranged marriages in Israel. People are free to choose their own spouse. It does not mean that a great deal of societal pressure cannot be brought on you to make sure you make the right choice.
Right, that's what I mean.
But yes. Yeah, but you know, I think the divorce, everything is permitted to you imagery in this poem, I think is really about God, is really about you. I think you're right about that. I think it's about your relationship with God. More than necessarily your relationship with, and it's an interesting imagery to use the imagery of divorce and freedom and the ability to choose about your relationship with God. But then, you know, but that does open different possibilities than being told like, this is what you must believe, which is why, you know, this subversive poem could actually bring you back to a different kind of belief, right? Everything is sweet and light and it's good. And of course, when it says it's good, then the light is good, that brings us right back to the creation of the world in the book of Genesis, right? This world that God gave us and this light is good. So, you know, this thing that may take us out of the framework of a more traditional ritual could allow us perhaps in the eyes of the poet to have a different kind of relationship with God that's more open and less restricted.